All right, hello everybody. Friday. Thank God it's Friday.
TG.
I say it for a reason, boy. It's great to be here at the end of the week. It's great. This is the best slot to have in the world.
Ever.
It really is.
You're always so happy at this time of day.
Right. You just get done through your work week, 5 o'clock, you walk out the door and say, you know what? Let's go on the radio and talk about music before we go home. That'd be a cool way to end the week.
Oh, yes,
it's great to be here. It's good to be me. How are you all doing, everybody? I'm Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan. And we're ready to bring you a new edition, a Friday edition of American Hit Radio. As you know, on Fridays, we call it How Music Changed, where we take in-depth looks at various aspects of the entire history of recorded music. We try to do it by focusing on one specific artist and or genre. We have a list that numbers 250 different entries that we plan to cover in this series. And what we are covering right now, I have been for the past 11 shows, this is actually show number 12, is the Rolling Stones. We've been taking an in-depth look at their career chronologically, playing pretty much all of their officially released stuff up until this point. I'm not worried too much about being completely purist. With the Beatles, I was obsessed about making sure I hit on everything. With
I'm
the Stones,
you're not now.
I'm doing pretty close to that with the Stones. I'm playing every album track. I'm playing every single and every B-side.
Tell yourself lies everywhere.
Well, the thing is, I'm not so worried. Like with the Beatles, I would be concerned if there were different mixes and things like that. With the Stones, I'm definitely not doing that. And I'm also not going to do that right through their entire career. I will take this up to some point in the, I would say somewhere around, say, the mid-70s. And then I can maybe start picking and choosing about how we work our way through some of the mid and latter period albums. I don't think we need to hear every single track in those instances because it starts to get redundant. We're doing it now because this is the point where the Rolling Stones were really vying for the title of the best rock and roll band in the world. They were direct competition for the Beatles. They had set themselves up sort of just as a commercial ploy as the anti-Beatles. It was an invention, really. They had nothing at all to do with the Beatles. They weren't really that remotely concerned with the Beatles. The Beatles were a pop band, they considered it. Mm-hmm. They considered themselves to be a blues band. They didn't.
Right.
They despised the whole idea of being a pop band. And yet...
Ironies.
Right, the irony of ironies. They end up basically, because of the fact that they were the same age as the Beatles, their audience began to sort of coalesce.
Right.
The same people. I mean, they liked the Beatles. You'd like the Stones, too. You might like them for different reasons, but it wasn't like you'd be completely different camps and you would like one and despise the other. Chances are, if you bought a Beatles album, you were buying a Stones album, too. You might prefer one over the other and you might be and be vocal about it. But at this point in time, you know, a rock and roll fan was a rock and roll fan. And now the Stones, by inventing themselves as the anti-Beatles, and then Mick Jagger, kind of sort of with a forced hand, writing lyrics that were sort of deliberately aimed at the social machine that was driving culture around that time, sort of to play up the bad boy image, suddenly found themselves in that role for real. They ended up sort of like becoming what they pretended to be. Almost, you know, it was an invention, yeah. And all of a sudden it became real.
Right.
So now here they are, basically. We're at this point in time, we're covering 1966 with today's show. And they start now, they are writing this time with really deliberately writing with an album in mind. It's really the first time they're doing this. Every album up until this point, and there's been, in America, there have been 5 albums released before 1966. In England, only 3. Typical in America, they'd collect a lot of odds and ends and release them as a package. By definition, those albums are just a real mix-up of really weird, different stuff. They're not cohesive at all. The other 3 were a combination of hit singles, B-sides, and various tracks that were recorded and assembled, but with no real sense of glue to hold them together. This album was the first example of them really trying to get the idea of pulling something together that would sound as though it really was one band, one unified vision, and one unified vision of a bunch of, you know, really, you know, what could you say? Definitely anti-Beatlesque attitudes and anti-cultural attitudes to come out on this record. I'm going to read a couple of excerpts here to make the point about what is happening. This is mostly coming from a book called The First 20 Years, which actually this book is pretty old now because it only covers up from about from 63 till about 83, but that's plenty for me.
Sure.
Anyway, an excerpt from there. In April, the single Paint It Black, backed with Stupid Girl, was released as a single in the United States. On April 15th, Aftermath, the first Stones album of all Jagger Richards' songs, was released in England. The album's release was delayed over a month due to censorship of the original title and album cover. It was to be called Could You Walk on the Water, featuring a photograph of the group up to their necks in water by Decca, and Decca Records refused under any terms to release that. They figured it highly offensive to Christians.
Probably right.
So the English Aftermath, by the way, differed quite a bit from the American album, which was released in June a few months later, in that the English version also included Mother's Little Helper, or I should say it did include Mother's Helper, in place of Painted Black, because in England, Painted Black came out as the single.
Right.
And you always get, you know, they still had that idea of give the fans something for their money
right.
over there.
They don't want to duplicate it.
Singles were singles and albums were albums. Now, in America, we would duplicate them so that you could get out more albums. So anyway, Mother's Little Helper was in place of Painted Black on the album, and it contained three additional tracks as well on the British version. Out of Time, Take It or Leave It, which didn't come out until the album Flowers in the United States, and another track called What to Do, which didn't appear at all in the States until it came out on More Hot Rocks. Anyway, the main change with this album was what was happening with Brian. All of a sudden,
yeah.
You know, Brian, who was... the blues guitar player, the slide player, and the guitar player that impressed the other Stones so much in the early days, was now pretty much expressing a disinterest toward the guitar. It seems like he didn't want to play it anymore.
How odd.
And instead of it, he was basically trying to find other instruments to get different textures. You can hear Brian's colors all over those RCA sessions, said Andrew Oldham, the band's manager, about the variety of styles and tonal inflections on Aftermath, where for the first time, the Chicago blues sound the Stones had earlier aspired to was now contained within the scope of the Stones' own music. For the first time, too, the Stones released an album, Aftermath, not only entirely written by Jagger Richards and containing some of Keith's first solo vocals, but for which a wide variety of instrumental sounds... such as dulcimer, harpsichord, marimbas, sitar, six-string guitars, and zoom bass, and different textures had been used. Unlike the Beatles, for whom exotic instruments and styles were their own reason for being there, the Stones needed the variety of voices projected on this album to express a wider range of disturbed, disturbing, and ambivalent emotional states. Aftermath is also the first Stones album released in stereo, as opposed to reprocessed mono, as all their earlier albums were. With this album, the Stones had finally come to terms with the possibilities of the studio. Unlike earlier LPs recorded on the run and in great sprawling chunks, Aftermath has a cohesiveness and totality of effect that in part comes from recording it all at the same studio, RCA, this time in California, and in two marathon sessions, December 1965 and May 1963. Regarding the first track on the American album and the single, Paint It Black, if you've ever seen the title, you might notice that it's always written as Paint It, comma, Black. And I'm surprised that it is addressed here, and I'm glad that it is, even though it's such a minor little thing. It's a dumb comma. But it always makes you like, what does that mean?
Right.
That makes no sense. Why is that comma there? And it's always been there. It's been there, you know, it still is on when you see the albums.
Mm-hmm.
As it reads here, the bizarre insertion of a comma, Painted Comma Black, by Decca caused allegations at first that the song was somehow racist. The accepted version of how Painted Black evolved, though, as described by Roy Carr, in its formative structure, it was considerably more rhythmic and funky. What happened was that during a break in a session, Bill Wyman slid behind a Hammond organ and began vamping out a parody of their original manager, Eric Easton, who had once been a professional organist. Charlie Watts quickly picked up the rhythm and thumped out the kind of stiff offbeat that accompanied harem dancing girls in Hollywood B-movies. Brian twanged the melody line on sitar, and from such bizarre beginnings, the arrangement that appears on the record was developed.
Wow.
A total, like, almost like, in other words, they were...
From a spoof. They were spoofing.
They were spoofing, mocking something, and they said, you know what? That's the track. Add the words. Here it is, painted black. Wyman again getting that pounding sound out of his bass. It was
a
weird track in 66 when it came out.
Yeah, I bet.
It's funny to hear Keith Richards' perspective on it. He writes about it in his book Life. This is Keith's own words about the track. There was certainly that conscious element in those RCA days from the end of 65 to summer of 66 of pushing the envelope in milder ways. There was Painted Black, for example, recorded in March 1966, our sixth British number one. Brian Jones, now transformed into a multi-instrumentalist, having, quote, given up playing the guitar, unquote, played sitar. It was a different style to everything I'd done before. Maybe it was the Jew in me. It's more to me like Hava Nagila or some gypsy lick. Maybe I picked it up from my granddad. It's definitely on a different curve to everything else. I'd moved around the world a bit. I was no longer strictly a Chicago blues man. Had to spread the wings a bit to come up with melodies and ideas, although I can't say that we ever played Tel Aviv or Romania. But you start to latch on to different things. With songwriting, it's a constant experiment. I've never done it consciously, like saying, I've got to explore such and such a thing. We were learning about making the album the center of attention, you know, the form for the music instead of just singles. Making an LP usually consisted of having two or three single hits and their B-sides and then filler. Everything was 2 minutes, 29 seconds for a single. Otherwise, you wouldn't get played on the radio. I talked with Paul McCartney about this recently. We changed it. Every track was a potential single. There was no filler. And if there was, it was an experiment. We'd use the extended time we had with an album just to make more of a statement, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about the record more than anything else is that all of a sudden with the Stones, I mean, obviously we said that they were making social commentary, really, on songs like Satisfaction and Get Off of My Cloud, even 19th Nervous Breakdown, was sort of like social observant songs. What starts happening on Aftermath is you start getting really seriously judgmental songs, particularly towards women. You could say that sort of began with 19th Nervous Breakdown, as they are openly mocking a rich socialite girl in that song. On Aftermath, they strip away all pretense, and there's just an amazing number of songs about women that, as objects, really, flat out writing about them as objects. And Keith addresses that, too. He writes, this wave of recording and songwriting culminated in the album Aftermath, and many of the songs we wrote around this time had what you might call anti-girl lyrics. Anti-girl titles, too. Stupid Girl, Under My Thumb, Out of Time, That Girl Belongs to Yesterday, and Yesterday's Papers. Who wants Yesterday's Girl? Nobody in the world. Maybe we were winding them up, and maybe some of the songs opened up their hearts a little, or their minds, to the idea of where women wear strong. But I think the Beatles and the Stones particularly did release chicks from the fact of, I'm just a little chick. It was not intentional or anything. It just became obvious as you were playing to them. When you've got 3,000 chicks in front of you that are ripping off their panties and throwing them at you, you realize what an awesome power you have unleashed. Everything they had been brought up not to do, they could do at a rock and roll show. So I guess being 21-year-old boys, seeing this happen, you start to pretty much do the math after a while. And you're looking at all these girls that are going totally bonkers, trying to break into your room, giving themselves up. And I guess you become a little bit judgmental. And you end up writing songs like this one, which was the second track on the album. Here is Stupid Girl.
Look at that stupid girl. She bitches back things that
In England, that was the A side and the B side of their single. Like I said, it was their sixth single to go straight to number one in Great Britain. It was eventually released in America with a different B side. We'll get to that later on. More notes about the A side in particular, though, and Brian in particular with the changes that were going on. Again, these are taken from that book, The First 20 Years. Although it must have been obvious that Brian's sitar playing was the antithesis of George's mellow accompaniments and transcendental interludes, John Lennon somewhat touchily cited Painted Black as yet another example of the Stones' musical larceny. His quote was, "Everything we do, the Stones copy 4 months later."
Whoa.
This seems in retrospect gratuitously petty, but the Stones, once mock rivals of the Fab Four, were becoming a real challenge to the Beatles as cultural and musical tastemakers. The Stones were becoming quite sensitive on the subject of their alleged Beatle borrowings. Mick explained to Keith Altham why they had only released As Tears Go By in the States. "Because we'd have to go through all that dreadful business about trying to copy the Beatles yesterday." But he's right. You know, I definitely would have been thinking that. Brian commented on the Stones-Beatles controversy by saying, "I've no delusions about being bigger than the Beatles. You must understand that the Beatles are a phenomenon." Now, on May 20th, Painted Black, with advance orders of 300,000 copies, entered the NME Top 30 at number 5. A week later, it was number 1. I'm sorry, it was their 7th consecutive British number 1 hit, according to this magazine. Asked by one reporter for the meaning of the Stones' number Painted Black, a sensitive lyric about a boy to whom everything looked black since his girl had left him, Mick Jagger replied in exasperation, "It means painted black. I can't get no satisfaction means I can't get no satisfaction. The rest of the song is just expanding on that."
Good for him.
So, don't expect, you know, these guys are not writing existentialism here. They're pop songs, and sometimes maybe not even all that brilliant. But
right, don't overthink it.
Right, just don't overthink it. Enjoy it.
I have to tell you that all the time.
And one of my favorite tracks as a kid, I remember the B-side. We'll play it now because it was on in this order on the album Aftermath. But I'm playing the American version because having known it, it's what I think is the superior version. And this track was actually the B-side of Mother's Little Helper, which, as I said, did not appear on the album. So it's kind of cool to that I knew this song as a B-side of a single, but it was actually an album track here. And again, you hear an awful lot of really brilliant work, I think, from Brian. It's kind of nice to hear how he's like adding these new Baroque touches on a song where the Stones, like as they had done with As Tears Go By, now they take it a step further, I think. There's a little bit more mystery, and they add the darkness to that side of their writing. It's beginning to work for them on all cylinders here. The song was called Lady Jane.
My sweet Lady Jane, when I see you again, your servant am I, and will humbly remain. Just heed this plea, my love, on bended knees, my love, I pledge myself to Lady Jane. My dear Lady Anne, I've done what I can. I must take my leave, for promised I am. My love, your time has come, my love, I pledge my troth to Lady Jane. my sweet Marie. I wait at your ease. The sands have run out for your lady and me. Wedlock is nigh, my love. Her station's right, my love. Life is secure with Lady Jane.
There was so much speculation about that song when it came out. I mean, just for implausibility, this song, it rates as a classic just by the fact that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards are composing a love madrigal. You know, it's a classic for that reason alone.
Right.
But the thing is, like, you know, everybody wanted to know, what is it about? What did it mean? Jagger, you know, led his then girlfriend, Chrissy Shrimpton, to believe that it was about her. But I wonder if she noticed that he got her name wrong.
Yeah, right.
Or perhaps Lady Jane Seymour, one of the six wives of Henry VIII, was being bandied about. Who did you say, Heidi? Jane?
I've got another last name, just left my mind.
Another, I guess, one of the
Jane Seymour.
Jane Seymour. Okay, yeah. Right, yeah.
Or the actress, though.
Oh, maybe. Oh, okay, there you go. Or maybe refer to one of Jagger's royal acquaintances, the Lady Jane Ormsby Gore, which he implied when he was in her presence.
Oh.
Some thought it might have been, you know, every song was about drugs, right? So
oh.
Lady Jane was marijuana.
Ooh-hoo.
You know, the evil marijuana. But considering that it's Jagger and Richard, you know, sometimes you think that the most licentious possibility is also the most likely.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read Lady Chatterley's Lover, the main character refers to his lover's private parts as Lady Jane.
Ah.
So, what do you think? I think that probably more or less,
I think I just solved the mystery for you all, didn't I? Ding, 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 ding. There you go. You hit the nail on the head.
All right, then. I figured that might have worked.
That's funny.
Right, isn't it? Okay, so let's see now. Where am I here? Again, I'm going to read a little bit from Keith's biography, life, for the next couple of songs, because there's a few interesting things here. We'd been on the road without a break for almost 4 years. The crack-ups were coming. We'd already had a wobbler with the formidable but brittle Andrew Oldham in Chicago in 1965 when we were recording at Chess. Andrew was a lover of speed, but this time he was drunk too and very distressed about his relationship with Sheila, his old lady at the time. He started waving a shooter around in my hotel room. This we didn't need. I had come all the way to Chicago to get shot by some wonky public schoolboy whose gun barrel I was staring down, which looked very ominous at the time, that little black hole. Mm-hmm. Mick and I got the gun away from him, slapped him around a bit, put him to bed and forgot about it. I don't even know what happened to the shooter. An automatic. Tossed it out the window, probably. We were just getting going. Let's make this a forget it. It's like my Aunt Peggy. Rather interesting. But Brian was a different story. What was comic about Brian was his illusions of grandeur even before he got famous. He thought it was his band for some weird reason. The first demonstration of Brian's aspirations was the discovery on our first tour that he was getting 5 pounds more a week than the rest of us because he'd persuaded Eric Easton that he was our leader.
Nice.
The whole deal with the band was we split everything like pirates. You put the booty on the table and split it, pieces of eight. You know, who do you think you are? I'm writing the songs around here and you're getting 5 pounds extra a week? Get out of here. It started with little things like that, which then exacerbated the friction between us as it went on, and he became more and more outrageous, as you could imagine. Let's see where else I can go with this. I never saw a guy so much affected by fame. The minute we'd had a couple of successful records, zoom, he was Venus and Jupiter rolled into one. Huge inferiority complex that you hadn't noticed. The minute the chick started screaming, he seemed to go through a whole change just when we didn't need it, when we needed to keep the whole thing tight and together. I've known a few that were really carried away by fame, but I never saw one that changed so dramatically overnight.
Crazy.
No, we're just getting lucky, pal. This is not fame. It went to his head, and over the next few years of very difficult road work in the mid-60s, you could not count on Brian at all. He was getting really stoned out of it. Thought he was an intellectual, a mystic philosopher. He was very impressed by other stars, but only because they were stars, not because of what they were good at. And he became a pain in the neck, a kind of rotting attachment.
Ew.
When you're schlepping 350 days a year on the road and you've got to drag a dead weight, it becomes pretty vicious. So you can tell that his opinions right now of Brian are beginning to slump. What probably really struck in Brian's craw was when Mick and I started writing the songs. He lost his status and then lost interest. Having to come to the studio and learn to play a song Mick and I had written would bring him down. It was like Brian's open wound. Brian's only solution became clinging to either Mick or me, which created a triangle of sorts. He had it in for Andrew Oldham. Mick and me, though, thought that there was a conspiracy to roll him out, which wasn't true at all, but somebody's got to write the songs. You're quite welcome. I'll sit around and write a song with you. What have you come up with? But no sparks flew when I was sitting around with Brian. And then it was, I don't like guitar anymore. I want to play marimbas. Another time, pal, we've got a tour to do. So we got to rely on him not being there. And if he turned up, it was a miracle. Mm-hmm. When he was there and came to life, he was incredibly nimble. He could pick up any instruments that were lying around and come up with something. Sitar on Painted Black, the marimbas on Under My Thumb. But for the next 5 days, we wouldn't see him. And we've still got a record to make. We've got sessions lined up, and where's Brian? Nobody can find him, and when they do, he's in a terrible condition. He barely ever played guitar in the last few years with us. Our whole thing was two guitars and everything else wove around that. And when the other guitar ain't there half the time or has lost interest in it, you got to start overdubbing. A lot of those records is me four times. I learned a lot more about recording doing that and also how to cover unexpected situations. And just by the process of overdubbing and talking to the engineers, I learned a lot more about microphones, about amplifiers, about changing sounds of guitars. Because if you've got one guitar playing all the parts, if you're not careful, it sounds like it. What you really want is to make them each sound different.
Right.
On albums like December's Children and Aftermath, I did the parts that Brian normally would have done. Sometimes I'd overlay eight guitars and then just maybe use one bar of the takes here and there in the mixing. So at the end of it, it sounds like it's two or three guitars and you're not even counting anymore. But there's actually eight in there and they're just in and out in the mix. Then Brian met Anita Pallenberg. He met her backstage around September 1965 at a show in Munich. She followed us to Berlin, where there was a spectacular riot, and then slowly, over several months, she started going out with Brian. She was working hard as a model and traveling about, but eventually she came to London, and she and Brian began their relationship with, soon enough, its bouts of high-volume violence. Brian graduated from his Humber Snipe to a Rolls-Royce, but he couldn't see out of that either. They make fun of him, mostly because he was a little small.
Oh.
Just sad.
Yeah.
Acid came into his picture around the same time. Brian disappeared late in 1965 when we were in mid-tour with the usual complaints of ill health and surfaced in New York, jamming with Bob Dylan, hanging with Lou Reed in the Velvet Underground, and doing acid.
Nice.
Rest in peace, Lou. Acid to Brian was something different than to your average drug taker. The dope at that time really wasn't, at least as far as the rest of us were concerned, a big deal. We were only smoking weed and taking a few uppers to keep us going. Acid made Brian feel he was one of an elite, like the acid test. It was that cliquishness. He wanted to be a part of something, could never find anything to be part of. I don't remember anybody else going about saying, I've taken acid. But Brian saw it as a sort of Congressional Medal of Honor. And then he'd come on like, you wouldn't know, man, I've been tripping. And he's primping himself, that terrible primping, the hair. The little idiosyncrasies became so annoying. It was the typical drug thing that they think they're somebody special. It's the head club. You'd meet people who'd say, are you a head? As if it conferred some special status. People who were stoned on something you hadn't taken. Their elitism was total BS. Ken Kesey's got a lot to answer for. Great attitude, Keith. Well, with that being said, here is Brian on that marimba playing another song that's obviously as misogynist as it gets, Under My Thumb.
Under my thumb.
Well, as far as misogynist songs go, there's a classic. I don't think you can get like more deliberately down on women, or a specific woman anyway, in general.
He was angry when he wrote that one, I guess.
It's down to me. The way she speaks when she's spoken to. It's down to me. The change has come. She's under my thumb. You know, this is what happens when you're in your early 20s. And you've got thousands of women screaming at you, throwing themselves at you. You start to see them as objects. And when you start writing songs, it's that object, that it's really not objectivity. At least it's a different meaning for the word. But it comes out where you're basically not seeing them as whole people because they're not acting like whole people. They're coming up to you. They're ripping your hair out, and they're tearing at your clothes, and they're hiding under your bed. They're offering,
freaky.
You know, it's so weird, you know, what was happening at this time. The free love thing wasn't really happening yet. There was a change coming, but it didn't happen yet. There's one more misogynistic song to play on this side before we move. There will be others, but one more specifically. And it's funny that they all came out just like this way on the album. Stupid Girl, into Lady Jane, into Under My Thumb, into this track entitled Don't You Bother Me.
Well, I'm looking for my face and I got it.
The cool thing about the album Aftermath is the tracks that are deep album tracks like that were taking on like sort of like a life of their own. They had like an aura of mystery about them. We'll cover the large majority of those next week. But there's one track really, and I'm talking about ending the show already. I know there's 15 minutes left, but I'll let Keith explain why I'm talking about it now. If LPs hadn't existed, probably the Beatles and ourselves wouldn't have lasted more than 2.5 years. You had to keep condensing, reducing what it was you wanted to say to please the distributor. Otherwise, radio stations wouldn't play it. Dylan's Visions of Johanna was the breakthrough. Going Home was 11 minutes long. It ain't going to be a single. Can you extend and expand the product? Can it be done? And that was really the main experiment. We said, you can't edit this. It either goes out like it is, or you're done with it. I've no doubt Dylan felt the same about Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands or Visions of Johanna. The record got bigger, and could anybody listen to that much? It's over 3 minutes. Can you keep their attention? Can you keep your audience? But it worked. The Beatles and ourselves probably made the album the vehicle for recording and hastened the demise of the single. It didn't go away immediately. You always needed a hit single. It just extended you without you even really knowing it. Okay, I'm just saying, I'm looking at track 11 before we're going to be queuing up. So with that being said, this is the track that actually ended Aftermath, so we'll use it to end our show. I think, not 100% certain of this, but I'm reasonably certain I can't think of anything else that the Stones have ever released in their career that was longer than this. I think it still remains the single longest Rolling Stones record in existence.
Wow.
Standing at 11 minutes and 35 seconds, according to the timing on the back of Aftermath. Here it is in its entirety, Going Home, which is what we're doing right now after this track. Take care, everybody. See you next week.
Spending too much time away. I can't stand another day. Maybe you think I've seen the world, but I'd rather see my girl. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. Going home, bone, 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 home, bone, 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 back home. Yes, I am. All those letters every day, maybe all right in their way, but I'd love to see your face when I get home in their place. I'm going home. 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 Bone, 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 home. Bone, 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 back home. Yes, I am. Yes, I will. When you're 3,000 miles away, I just never sleep the same. If I pack my things right now, I could be home in 7 hours. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. Gone home.
going home, bone, 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 home, bone, 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 back home. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. I see my baby. I see my baby. I wanna see my girl. I just can't wait. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just can't wait. I see my baby. She'll make me feel all right. For my baby, you gonna go in the early morning, baby. Early in the morning, early in the morning, gonna catch that plane. I'm gonna catch that plane. Now it won't be long. I said, listen to me, it won't be long. My baby. Yes, it is. It's such a long, long time. 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 Yes, it is. Yes, 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 yes. Ow! I'm gonna see my baby one more time. Night out.
good. She made me feel all right. She made me feel so good.
Every A-side's got a B-side, so we'll end our show with the B-side of that single. A pretty good tune, actually, on a different plane. As you can tell, the Jack and Richard are beginning to pull together. This track is called Sad Day, and unfortunately it is sad because our show is over.
Aww.
Hope you can join us next week as we continue to look at the Stones covering the album Aftermath. See you then, folks. Take care. Thank you, Heidi.
Bye.
Someone will. Still hear the things you say.